Better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. This particular verse he starts out is, it's kind of one of those better than verses. You know, better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting and strife. Now, of course, it doesn't take much to see the obvious nature of this. But, you know, the funny thing is, you know, some people have an eye for true value and others don't. Some people, for example, an antique dealer can perceive true value in what maybe the normal eye would just see, you know, garage sale fodder. Can't see any value in that particular thing, but an antique dealer would be able to recognize it. You might be letting it go for $10 and they might turn around and make $300-$400 on it simply because they know what you may not know. Same thing is with people who study art. They can see things in quality in art. And of course, that's debatable in some respects of what true art is considered. But I think of this and I think, isn't it amazing how an eye can be trained to see things what the ordinary eye could not? I feel bad for that rock collector in Texas who didn't have the eye he thought he had when he let go a $500,000 rock in his flea market sale for $10. Didn't know. True story. I mean, can you imagine being that guy? He didn't see the value in it. And I think, likewise, we as Christians need to constantly be growing and learning to see what the real value is in our salvation, to see the value in things that even through difficulties and trials, God turns for good, or to see the difference between a dry morsel with peace and a house full of, you know, the sacrificial meat and the feasting and all the luxurious foods with strife. Which would you prefer? Now, I know you're probably saying, well, I'd like the feast with quietness. I want both. I want my cake and eat it too. But you know, one thing I think is we don't see is how God has to deal with our heart to help us to see what's most important. And when we choose those most important ways, it's amazing how then everything else comes in play. Notice verse 2. A wise servant will rule over a son who causes shame, and will share an inheritance among the brothers. You know, this is a type to me of the gospel. The meek shall inherit the earth, the Bible says. You know, we may only have a temporary interest in this world now, but it shall be turned over one day to us who are God's in Christ. One day you'll inherit the earth when you're a follower of the Lord. In some respects, one pastor put it, the meek have already inherited the earth because they can enjoy all the things around them, and they don't have to have ownership necessarily. I mean, think about it. What does that ownership mean? You know, we got a piece of paper with our name on it that says such and such at the bottom of such and such owns this. I own this. So I can say, see, I've got a piece of paper. That's mine. What is that? Does that really matter? Can you enjoy things without owning them? I submit the more you own, the more you can enjoy it because you've got so many things to take care of, so many things to worry about. You know, the meek really can enjoy. I can enjoy driving through various nice places in, you know, various cities and enjoy the beautiful scenery and the houses and everything. And I don't have to take care of it. It's a blessing. The meek shall inherit the earth. But, you know, I look at how this particular servant who really has no authority, no opportunity, he's got no inheritance, yet he's going to make out better in the end because of his wisdom. That's the value of wisdom. Do you see the value of wisdom? Well, look at Joseph, who was sold as a slave by his own brothers, who was in Egypt and then falsely accused and put in prison. But because he was wise, because he looked to the Lord, amazing thing, what happened? Amazing thing is that God raised him up. David, too. Here he's the youngest son of Jesse. He's going to be not in the who's who because he is nobody. Yet when you're the youngest in a family in that culture, it was like you were at the mercy of everybody else. The oldest, you know, son got the inheritance. You got nothing. You were at his mercy. But here is David, the youngest son, because he honored God. God raised him up to be commander in chief. Daniel, a young man being stripped away from his family by the Babylonians, carried away into a foreign land, away from his family and friends, and yet God raised him up to be second in command. Each one of these cases are a perfect place of the value of wisdom being in connection with the Lord. How you'll share an inheritance even among those who have a right. Verse 3 is our verse to remember. In fact, this verse is on theversetoremember.com. If you go to that website, along with some comments and some of the notes that I have here, and you can check it out for yourself. The refining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests the hearts. The thing that strikes me about this process of refining metals is there is a great amount of heat, pressure, sometimes harsh chemicals that are applied to those metals in order to bring out a more pure form. The whole thing the Lord is into, of course, is purifying our hearts. He's the one that tests our hearts. Now, the first thing that I love is the fact that He knows my heart better than I know myself. I think I know myself. I think I know what's best for me. And I think I know what my motives are. But really, God sees. He knows everything. His eyes are a flame of fire, Revelation says, and He sees right through to the very heart of the issue. He sees my heart. I cannot hide. In fact, Solomon in his prayer, he prayed, Lord, you know, you hear in heaven and forgive and act and give to everyone according to his ways, whose heart you know, for you alone know the hearts of the sons of men. Only the Lord can search the very depths, because we put layer upon layer upon layer of surface things on it. And sometimes we don't even know ourselves. But His eyes see. And of course, He sets about for our good. He's into taking our heart. He searches the heart. He tests the mind. Now, anytime the Lord puts us through a test, we must understand it's for a good purpose. For example, even when we manufacture equipment and we're going to put a vehicle together, there are certain standards that vehicle must match. There are tests that all those pieces of equipment undergo in order to be proved valuable. Now, here you've got a pipe that's rated at, 350 PSI or whatever it might be, or 3,500 pounds per square inch. So what they do is they put about 5,000 pounds per square inch in it, and they keep doing it until the pipe bursts. They're trying to destroy this pipe, but only to prove its worth. In a way, it seems to us, when we go through trials and difficulties and pains and problems, it seems like God's hand is heavy upon us. He's hurting us. Why is He allowing this? You see, what we need to know is that it's for our good. He's testing our worth. And there's no small fire that can separate the base alloy in gold and silver. It needs to be hot. Because there are often mixtures in the substances. Mixtures you might not even see. Or in the iron ore, there might not even be a resemblance. Maybe just the gold and the silver are in ion form, and that has to go through a process to even recognize the value. And this is what the Lord is about doing with our heart. Something must be done with the plague of our heart, which is sin. And the Lord sometimes has to use drastic measures. Now, it's good to know that He won't go all the way unless it's needed. Like C.S. Lewis put, that the Lord whispers in our circumstances. He's there. He's nudging us on. And if we have a sensitive heart and conscience, we'll hear. But if we're stubborn and rebellious, then He speaks a little bit louder in trials and difficulties. And if we still don't get it, He finds it necessary at times to shout through pain. Now, it's not His desire. He doesn't want to go there, and He's not going to go there. He's not going to take extreme measures unless extreme measures are needed. But I'll notice one thing, is that no discipline seems joyful but painful, and yet the Lord is into eventually the peace that comes from the yieldedness to righteousness, the fruit that comes from that. You know, another thing about refining process is that the person who is refining metals has to pay very close attention to the exact amount of heat, the exact amount of pressure that's being applied. Otherwise, the metal will be destroyed. In fact, that's one thing that when you understand how God is very intimately acquainted with all of our ways, He is there with us. And when the metal is truly reaching its purified form, how can you tell whether it's ready? One silversmith was asked, how can you tell when the refining process is complete? He said, when I can see my image in the silver, then I know. Isn't that a great picture? It's like the Lord, when He can see His image in our life, then He knows the product is near complete. We want to be more like Jesus. That's the ultimate response. Refining pot is for silver, the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests the hearts. Now, of course, in the testing process, the target is often our faith. James says To count it all joy, brother, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the trying of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, knowing that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. This is the point. We should count it all joy because he's working something good. Now think about that for a moment. You might be thinking of patience. I know I'd like patience, but is it that big of a deal? Is it such a bad thing to be impatient from time to time? Well, you might be thinking that, but the word patience in the Greek is a word called hupomone. And hupomone is a word that means abiding. It's not an Italian ice dessert. It's abiding under the circumstance. It's learning a settledness. Even in a tough situation, you can handle it. You can endure. And in that enduring process, there's a lot of good things happening. To be able to run and not get weary. Waiting on God's timing is a lesson we all need to learn. And this is what God does within us. In fact, four things that when our faith is tested, it produces in us. Number one, we learn a lot more about ourselves, don't we, when we go through a trial? We do. We learn a lot about ourselves. We know what's going to cause us to break. And, you know, the process is now seen. Okay, we're weak in this area. God has to shore us up there. Another thing is we learn the greatness of God. We learn how weak we are in one hand, but we learn how great he is on the other hand, how he can come through and deliver, how the darker it is, the more beautiful his light is expressed. If you go into a dark cave where you can't see your hand in front of your face, one little candle puts off more light than you can imagine. Now, if I were to light a candle right here with all this light, you wouldn't even hardly see the light of the candle. But in a dark cave, it could light the entire cave up. So often, we see God's glory in direct proportion to the darkness of the situation we're in. And all the false shining lights in this world that distract us so often from true peace and truth, it keeps us from understanding until we go through that crucible and that furnace and that difficulty. We also learn obedience through the things we suffered. You know, Jesus, the Bible said, even learned obedience through the things he suffered. He took upon himself the form of a servant and now had to learn obedience. And he did through the things he suffered. But here this patience is the key. It's coming to a place of enduring and persevering and steadfastness. There are too many Christian cream puffs in the world today. They're too touchy-feely and just want to have a feel-good experience. And they're not really disciplined. They don't want to hear about battles and self-denials and difficulties and any of these areas. But this is the very thing that we grow in. So the Lord tests the hearts. And our response is to count it all joy. You know, one daughter was complaining to her father about some trials that she was going through. And her father was a chef, put some pots on the stove. And he took some carrots, some eggs, and some coffee beans, and he put them in separate pots and brought them to a boil. And after a while, he asked his daughter to pull out the carrots and see what they felt like. And she said, "They're all soft." "Pull out the eggs," he said, "and they were all hard." He says, "Now pull out the coffee beans." And she said, "Well, they've kind of become one with the water." He said to his daughter, "This is the key. Some people under difficulties are too soft and they get mushy. Others under difficulties turn hard and bitter. But some under difficulties, they allow that difficulty to be change them and they change the difficulty into a sweetness that's a product that's well usable." So are you a carrot, an egg, or a coffee bean this morning? How do you respond to those difficulties and trials? How do you reach up and say, "Okay, there's a purpose here. I don't understand it, but the Lord knows." To look to Jesus so that we can press on. "No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to all of us. God is faithful, who won't allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation, give you a way of escape." It's important to see that. Now let's jump to verse 4. "An evildoer gives heed to false lips, and a liar listens eagerly to spiteful tongue." An evildoer gives heed to false or evil lips. Here's an interesting thing. The very sin that a person commits makes them susceptible to sin. Here is a person that's giving heed because to wrong and evil because he is evil. It's almost like Amnon. If you remember that story in the Old Testament, he was David's son, and he had a sister, a half-sister, same father, different mother, whose name was Tamar. She was beautiful. And he lusted after her, but he couldn't have her because they were close related. And so he wanted her, and in his lust and his desire for her, it made him susceptible to some bad counsel of a foolish friend who told him, do this and this and this, and then you can be with her. And basically, in effect, he ended up raping her. What a horrible situation. Eventually, it cost him his life, but it's a perfect example of an evildoer giving heed to evil lips. You know, you become susceptible with the very thing that you let control you. Ahab is another case. The king of Israel at one time yet had a wife by the name of Jezebel. And he listened to her because it was in his own heart, and she was a very evil woman. And so many problems came to the nation as a result. And do you know that those who are most susceptible to cons are con artists themselves? They fall victim to their own swindles. Verse 5, he says, he who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. Here's a person that would go so far as to mock the poor. What a horrible thing. In fact, I remember some years ago when we first came out here to New Jersey. We were in New York. I was picking up some sound equipment. It was when the church was really small. And I had the sound equipment. We were waiting for the train there in Penn Station. And this homeless lady came by. She had some bags in her hands. And one of the bags of cans and bottles had saturated with wetness in the bottom. And it soaked through, and all the bottles and cans just fell out as she was walking by us. We empathized. We reached out to help. As while we were doing that, I saw this guy. My wife and I were both there. We see this guy. He's dressed in this real nice suit, and he's looking all sharp. And, you know, executive of some sort. And he said, oh, let me help this woman, really mockingly to her. And it really hurt my heart. I gave him one of those looks like, I'd like to hit you. And see, a Christian can get away with that, you know, as long as you don't hit him. But you can give him the look. And my wife said, that slime, I can't believe that. And so we helped the lady pick up her bottles, and actually had an extra bag. I consolidated some things and I gave her the bag for the bottles that she had. But it just struck me that here was a man who's made it in his life, and yet he has nothing more enjoyable to do than to mock the poor. You know, how dependent. I wonder where that guy is right now. I wonder if he's even listening on the radio when this thing eventually goes to the radio. That would be an amazing thing. If you're the guy, give me a call. I'd like to talk with you to see what God has done in your life. You know, he who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. You know, when I think about calamity and someone that's actually glad, you might have been tempted at times, perhaps, if you've heard of someone that has never liked you and has hurt you in the past, something bad has happened to them. You might have been tempted to rejoice over that. Don't do it, though. Don't do it. The Lord is not pleased when even your enemy struggles that you would rejoice over that. In fact, there have been many people that, a number of people that have hurt us in the past, and we've heard some situation has happened and tragedy has struck, and we've reached out to them in compassion and sent a card, and, you know, because that's the response the Lord would want us to have. You know, if you're glad at somebody else's calamity, you're going to one day have calamity. Verse 6, children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children is their father. You know, in the time of Israel, of course, they, following the laws and the regulations, many of the diet and health laws, they lived longer. They weren't susceptible to the diseases of Egypt because of the many sins that would, you know, probably sexually transmitted diseases and all kinds of other horrible things because of the pagan practices. But they lived longer. And naturally, when you live longer, you get to see your children and your children's children and your children's children's children. And that is a great blessing. I'm not a grandfather. I hope to be one day. Kids have to get married first, of course. But I hope to be one day. And I see some of my pastor friends who are grandfathers, and they just, I'll tell you, they dote over their kids. And, you know, being a grandparent is great. I mean, you get to enjoy them, and then you can send them home, you know. And it's just a sweet thing. And besides, grandparents have more time. At least they should have more time than parents. They can enjoy kids. They're not as rushed. Kids can enjoy grandparents. But a children's children are the crown of old men. It's kind of a proof that you've lived a long life and you've been blessed in that respect. And the glory of children is their father. This should be. That father should be one that sets the tone and the mark and the example. How many fathers are reneging on their responsibility here? And some of them not even providing for their own family. What a tragedy. Excellent speech is not becoming to a fool, much less lying lips to a prince. You've got a picture here of reputation. You know, you fool's going to have a reputation of being foolish, but here is a person that's breaking that reputation. He's got excellent speech. That's not fitting, because here you've got a person that does not believe in God. The fool says in his heart there is no God. So that's the definition of fool in the Bible. You know, a fool is one who does not believe in God, and yet he's got excellent, witty, clever arguments to base and substantiate his views. You know, he's going to debate it. And I've heard debates with atheists and Christian scholars. Oftentimes, however, the debate is set up so that the opposing side has the weakest person to represent their case so that you look better. And this happens a lot on TV. Don't be deceived when you see some Christian being interviewed about something and they make him look stupid. It's because they've basically not chosen one of the persons that can best represent that view. They've chosen someone that's not that good or eloquent with their words, and they put them up against some person over here arguing the bad side that's very clever and very witty and can really dazzle the crowds. It's not a fair representation. I mean, I would never put myself in a position, though I dabble in some things in science, I would never debate someone over some scientific issue of evolution or creation. I wouldn't have the skill and the ability. You know, and of course the media would love for someone like a pastor to debate some scientist, because that would make the pastor look really foolish. And some pastors actually take it upon themselves to go in those positions, and I think it's unwise. But excellent speech is not becoming to a fool, much less lying lips to a prince. Hey, if you're in authority, you should have truthfulness. A present is a precious stone in the eyes of its possessor. Wherever he turns, he prospers. Doesn't come out that clear in the English, but he's really referring to a bribe and the magical way a bribe works. Now, a bribe's not a good thing, but the proverb recognizes that, you know, you've got a person that's using a bribe and can use it quite well. Why does a bribe work in many cases? Because it appeals to the covetousness in a person. And again, if you're susceptible to covetousness, then you're going to be susceptible to bribes, and you will be open to making foolish decisions. You know, I'm amazed at how many Christians even get caught up with doctrines that really have no basis in Scripture. And they're often appealing. In fact, Peter tells us about false prophets. They appeal to the lust of the flesh. They know how to work a crowd into appealing to their baser nature. Greed, for example. You know, it's appalling to me how many Christians are carried away by their own lusts for control and money to listen to many what would be considered popular Christian TV salesmen, I would call them, promising great riches from God if you send them a check for $20. Yet, why do we do that? Why do people do that? Why do people follow these charlatans? We're ripping them off. Paul even lamented that with the Corinthian church. He said, you know, you put up with those who rip you off. He says, but, you know, the more I've loved you, the less I'm loved. Why is that? Because I think it's an appeal to what's in the heart of man, the carnal nature. You know, to promise someone, you know, if you send in $100 to our ministry, God is going to bless that 100-fold. You watch for your check in the mail. It's going to come. $10,000 will come to you, you know. And you know what? What's the motivation there? Greed. It's an appeal to greed. It's sad, because I believe there wouldn't be so many open mouths along these lines if there weren't as many willing ears for this junk. But it's a very popular way to go. And, you know, but the point is, it comes down to this, as verse 8 expresses. It's a bribe. Present is a precious stone in the eyes. Wherever he turns, it prospers. He can use that bribe to get people to do what they want, but it's not right in the end. Verse 9 says, he who covers a transgression seeks love, and he who repeats a matter separates friends. You know, a friend loves at all times, and he's going to cover that sin. He's not going to slander. You know, he's not going to use that information. Rebuke is more effective for a wise man than 100 blows on a fool. You know, this theme of teachability is so important that here you have the example that you've got a person who's open to a single rebuke, where another person isn't going to be moved with 100 blows to his person. You know, tender-hearted openness to learn and grow is a precious gift. You know, we don't want to be so pressed by blows that, you know, we need some heavy circumstance to finally get our attention. Are you like that in your life, where it takes some drastic thing to happen to you to finally get your attention? If that's the case, then that's where we most of us are to start. But as you grow in the Lord, you want to cultivate a tender conscience, a sensitivity, an openness. I used to think growing up, I didn't like to have to, you know, that feeling of guilt by doing something wrong. And I thought it was a sign of maturity when I could overcome those feelings of guilt, where I could do wrong and not feel guilty about it. I thought, yeah, that's good. No, that was bad. As I look back, the pain it caused me to harden my conscience and get it branded like a seared so it had no sensitivity. Better to have a tender conscience, just to be sensitive to a rebuke. You know, invariably in my own life, I have experienced this, where when I felt, you know, a check in my spirit about something, the Lord warning me, don't go down that road, and I haven't listened, it's been a painful experience then that I've had to learn. And it's true in our lives. You know, if I turn on a TV show and it's questionable, and there's that still small voice that is saying, you know, you shouldn't be watching this. If I'm sensitive to that and turn the channel, it's like I'm listening to that gentle rebuke. And I'm cultivating more of a sensitivity then. The Lord will speak to me, and I don't have to wait till it gets hot and the fire's turned up real difficult to change my heart. I can change very sensitively to the Lord. Some people don't listen to that. And when you don't, you become more and more foolish until eventually 100 blows won't even get through to you. An evil man seeks only rebellion. Therefore, a cruel messenger will be sent against him. Notice verse 11 here. Here is a person, what I look at this as what goes around comes around. I've seen people in ministry, in fact, you know, not quite learn the lessons before they go out and they maybe plant a church or something to that effect. And their training and development, there have been things that have been missing, and how they are toward others is going to come back to them. You know, what goes around comes around. This is the verse right here. You know, you've got an evil man seeking rebellion, and then eventually a cruel messenger is going to be sent against him. You know, I told my pastor after being here for a couple of years that I now understood what he was trying to embed in our hearts, all those staff meetings. Now I understood. I could see it from his angle, as you learn. Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs rather than a fool in his folly. You know, stay clear of foolish people. And who is a foolish person? Again, those who say in their hearts there is no God. They might believe in God, they might go to church, but in their heart, there's no room for God to really guide them. Better for you to meet a bear robbed of its cubs. Now, that'd be a pretty vicious meeting. You know, can you imagine a female bear who thinks you took her cubs? You're in deep trouble. She'll rip you to pieces. Well, you'd be better off in that case than meet a fool in his folly. Why? For if fools don't honor God, do you think they're going to honor you? You know, one of the qualities I look for in a person that gets involved in ministry is they have a healthy fear of God, that they know they're going to give an account of their life. If they think they can get away with something, that's not healthy, because they're going to do things that aren't right. They're going to treat people wrongly. They're going to abuse authority. Whoever rewards evil for good, evil will not depart from his house. It's going to come back. Rewarding evil for good. You know, it's bad enough to reward evil for evil. Someone does something wrong to you to give it back to them in their face. I mean, that's natural, but that's not what we should be. We should turn the other cheek. We should reward good for evil. But here is a man who rewards evil for good. That's very odious. That's very wicked. Evil will never depart from his house. He's only signing his own death warrant. The beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts. I don't have to say much about this one. Because you know what it takes to push somebody's buttons, don't you? You know, if you're married, those few choice little clever words that you put together, you know they can really stir up some. You know, once you say them, that's it. You're sleeping on the couch. I mean, once you go down that road, once you get to that point of no return, it's all over. The wise person stops it before it gets to that point. You know, how many times I see where something's going and I go, you know, I don't want to go there. And I'll even say to myself, I'm not going there. It's just not going to happen. I can see where it's leading. The beginning of strife is like releasing water, but once it's released, you know, if you pour a bucket of water out in the ground, try recovering that water back in the bucket. You ever try to do that? You can't do it. When you speak a word, try pulling that word back in. It's the same thing. It's like releasing water. You can't pull it back. Once you start it, it's out there. And it's going to be a problem. So start it before you even begin to empty out all of your brain into words. And pretty soon your whole brain is leaked out. Verse 15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. Now, you might want to write next to this, lawyers. Now, I'm not picking on lawyers. I do sometimes, and I repent of that. But I'm saying this because this is a lawyer's verse. I think every lawyer should have this emblazoned in bronze on his desk. Because I think this is the foundation for justice. Now, most of our jurisprudence has been built upon the Judeo-Christian ethic. And I got to say that our justice system is the best in the world, in my opinion. But it's got some problems. There's some intrinsic difficulties with our justice system because it's more important in our cases to win than it is to discover truth. And that's the problem. And you get a clever attorney who can really sound good. He's only interested in winning. He might know that his client is guilty of sin. But he is going to do what he can with all of his clever ways to try to find some loophole. How many murderers and thieves have been let loose by a loophole? Now, I understand the difficulty. If you're a prosecuting or a defense attorney that's you're prescribed to help a particular person out, you're appointed by the state, you've got to do your job. You've got to put the best case forward. Even if you think the guy's guilty, you've got to do your job. But don't do it too well if you know the guy's guilty. See, that's a hard one. Isn't that a moral dilemma? You got to do your best, but when you know the guy's guilty, what do you do? And this is the problem. We are not interested in truth as much as winning. And that is, it presents a difficulty. But God holds it an abomination. He hates that the wicked would be justified and the just would be condemned. And it has happened. How many just individuals have been convicted because they couldn't find the real person? And, well, they'll set up this guy because he's a flake anyway. It happens. I heard of a pastor in Texas or Arizona, I can't remember, who had a dream about a girl who was raped and killed. And it was a very vivid dream with some details he just never had in a dream before. And he was very concerned. And then he saw it in the newspaper. And so he went to the police and he said, this is going to sound really strange, but I had a dream about this case. And he gave some details about it. They arrested him because they assumed only the killer could have known those details. He was eventually convicted, and he's in prison right now. And he's trying to appeal his case. I don't know where it is right now, but I think there's some hypocrisy there because in many precincts, do you know that they actually use psychics in order to try to solve a case? So on the one hand, they convict the guy because they have no room for the supernatural. There's no way you could have had a dream. You must be the killer. But on the other hand, next week, they're going to be in a double standard by hiring a psychic to help them solve another case. See, there are some problems. But convicting the guilty is not as important as presenting the most fancy argument. And this is a sign our system is wrong in this area and it should be changed. Verse 16, why is there in the hand of a fool the purchase price of wisdom, since he has no heart for it? I would put it this way. Why pay tuition for a student whose heart isn't in the study? You're wasting your money. His heart's not there. And it's true, when I think of the people that Jesus encountered, like Herod, for example. Herod was a guy that had the most precious gem right in front of him. Jesus was more precious than rubies. He's right under his nose. But he was just curious. His interest in truth was just curiosity. It was no motivation to discover truth. He had no real heart for it. Though he wanted to know, it wasn't really for the right purposes. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. I used to think that I saw this as a brother is born to fight with his other brother. a brother is born to just their sibling rivalry. And I used to think that's what this verse meant until I realized that studying it, here's the difference. A friend loves at all times. Big things, small things, a friend is always there for you. But family, they only come together when there's a crisis many times. You know, when there's a difficulty, hey, blood is thicker than water. They're going to be there for you. But a friend is there at all times. Which to me illustrates the importance of cultivating friendships. How much we need that. If you don't have good Christian friends here, if you're just coming to church on Sunday and you don't know any other Christians and you're content to be that way, you're not going to really grow. Because you don't have real friends that are going to help you spiritually and encourage you and challenge you and help you when you're struggling in things in your marriage or your job or other issues that you're going to need guidance and counsel. Oh, to have a group of friends that we can drop in on any time and that there's a need that it's going to be met. And that, of course, to have friends, you have to be friendly, the Bible says. But a friend loves at all times. A man devoid of understanding shakes hands in a pledge and becomes surety for his friend. This is just the absolute foolishness to commit to that which you don't understand. You're going to be accountable for. To be responsible for someone else's debt. It's not wise. It's not wise at all. It's foolish because you've relieved that person from responsibility. They need that responsibility. Now they don't have it because you're now signing. You've co-signed. If anything happens, it's going to come back to you. You're going to be ultimately responsible. And that's very, very foolish. Unless you're willing to lose everything that you committed to. I mean, if you're prepared to give it away, then fine, go ahead. But if you're not prepared, if you're not thinking that it's going to really cost you, if you think, well, I hope everything works out and I'll sign, but you know, you better be faithful to pay that. Well, you've just signed it for yourself. It's not wise to do that. But there's also something more in this. Here's a person shaking hands in a pledge. He's pledging himself to something that he doesn't understand. You know, I think of how many people commit to some secret society. Some lodge or some form of social thing that they have to sign something with their life, you know, and be committed unto the death to something. And only after they sign on the dotted line do they reveal the secrets of the society. Now, how stupid is that? Really? I mean, I can't put it any other way. I might offend some of you, but think about it. You're committing your life to that which you don't understand. What if I said to you, look, this is a great Bible. I want you to believe every word about it. I want you to put your life on it. And once you decide, then we'll open it up and discover what's in here. You wouldn't do that. Would you buy a car that way? Would you say, okay, I'm going to give you $10,000 for that car. I haven't seen it yet. And, you know, I think it's pretty good. But you're not going to show it to me till after I pay the $10,000. So I'll pay the $10,000, then you can show it to me. Would you do that? Of course not. Why do people sign up on something that they're giving their life to because other people have done it and they say it's okay? And well, if it's all okay, then why don't they tell you all the secrets before you sign? See, it's making pledge. You're becoming surety, and you're devoid of understanding to do that. Verse 19, he who loves transgression loves strife. And he who exalts his gate seeks destruction. You know, here you got a guy loving sin and exalting himself. Bad combination and will only lead to destruction. Verse 20, he who has a deceitful heart finds no good. And he who has a perverse tongue falls into evil. You know, again, it's like the nature of sin itself is punishment for sin. You've got a deceitful heart, you're not going to find good. He who begets a scoffer does so to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. That is true. It's so tough. When you see your kids finding the Lord and walking with the Lord, there's no greater joy in that. But when they don't, oh, it's such a hard thing. And there's prayer meetings in the church just for this. Parents with teens who are struggling, and you know, it's just a burden on your heart to pray. A merry heart, verse 22, does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. You could write next to this one, my daily prescription. Because this is what this is. This is your key to health, a merry heart. Now, does merriness and joyfulness and cheerfulness depend upon circumstances? No. Jesus said, you know, be of good cheer. In this world, you're going to have tribulation. In fact, many times in the Bible, the Lord said that one Greek word, therse, which meant be of good cheer. Sometimes it's translated fear not. The same word, though, it's be of good cheer. Be merry. Be joyful. Count it all joy. Rejoice. I think of Jesus and I think, man, if he weren't crucified, he would have probably lived a long life because there is something that happens to you. It's, in fact, there's a lot of research on this. You can actually look up some stuff on the internet, and there are laughter therapy pages all throughout the internet, different doctors that are prescribing just laughter. And when you're going through a difficult time, one guy who had an incurable disease decided he was going to treat himself with just watching Abbott and Costello movies. And seriously, this is true. Charlie Chaplin movies and just laugh. And his laughter, he just did everything he could just to change his attitude and laugh, and the disease went away. And he believes that your body can heal itself if you're not adding undue stress to it. And Mary, cheerful heart, does good like medicine. The Bible says it should be enough for us. We don't need any outside research. It's good enough for us to believe that. Why do you think we're called to rejoice always? Can I say rejoice, Paul says. It's healthy. Show me a praising person. Not that everything's going good in his life. If you see someone rejoicing, don't assume that everything's always fine. Sometimes I visit people in the hospital and they're rejoicing. Things are tough, but they're rejoicing. And there's that peace. Merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. There's something very much connected to your physical health here. A wicked man accepts a bribe behind the back to pervert the ways of justice. Again, this you're covetous and you're susceptible to things. You accepting a bribe. Wisdom is in the sight of him who has understanding, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. See, there's satisfaction to those who are wise. It's right in their grasp to those who have understanding. But the eyes of a fool, nothing satisfied. His eyes are everywhere. At the ends of the earth, he's wandering about trying to find life, find happiness, find joy. A foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her who bore him. Similar to the other verse we just read. Also, verse 26, he says, to punish the righteous is not good, nor to strike princes for their uprightness. Now, if verse 15 was the lawyer's verse, this could be the judge's verse. You know, to punish the righteous is not good. To uphold justice. Verse 27, he who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. In fact, it's so true, notice verse 28, even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he's considered perceptive. I like that. Better to be thought of a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. You've heard that one. You know, sometimes you hear people that are just talkative. You know, you might be standing in a grocery store line and, you know, someone's talking and talking and what they're talking about, it's so just inane, but they're just talkative. And you go, yep, there's a fool. I can hear that one. No doubt about that one. But, you know, when someone's quiet, you don't know. They're thoughtful. And this is why. Verse 27 says, he who has knowledge spares his words. Now, the sound of all those Bibles closing is rather disconcerting right now. Just for that, I'm going to go for another 20 minutes. No. I'll close my Bible now then. But I want to finish with this thought. As we mature and become more like Christ, that's the goal. This is what the Lord, he sees the finished product within us. And he sees us often by faith. He sees us in process. Just like Peter, he could say to the most unstable of them all, you're going to be a stone, Peter. I'm going to call you stone. You're going to be stable. You're going to be on the rock. He saw what he was becoming. And certainly Peter became that. So we are becoming more and more like Christ. God is working in us. We're in process. But this is the process. As gold in the furnace and silver to the fire, so the Lord tests the hearts. He tests the hearts. He puts us through those things so that we can come out shiny like gold and pure like silver. that we can have the greatest amount of peace. You know, God has a bad reputation in the world, unfortunately, because it's been spread by false information. God, to the people in the world, is a killjoy. He is not happy when you're happy. He's only happy when he, you know, smacks you around a little bit. And that if you're having any fun at all, he's going to be very disappointed in you. We think that God is out for our bad rather than our good. Or we think that following him in his way, our life will be boring, our life will be miserable. This is so far from the truth. God is interested that we be purified. So yes, we go through trials so that the outer product, the final product, is that we have peace. That we have joy. A merry heart. He wants to see us healthy and just trusting him and not moved by circumstances. When things are good or bad, it doesn't matter. We got that even keel. And people see that, and then he gets a better reputation because you're his ambassador. You're representing him. What are you representing to the world about God? Is he a sour God in heaven that's not happy with anything? Is that what's on your face when you go to work? Are you miserable and just unhappy and complaining and whining? And you're giving the Lord a bad reputation because that's not what he's like. He wants you to be filled with joy. He wants you to come through those testings. Now again, he doesn't want to put the fire up so hot. He only does that if it's necessary. If we would judge ourselves, we wouldn't be judged. If we would learn to cultivate that sensitive conscience to the Lord and be listening to those little things that he tells us, he would open that door for the most amount of joy that we could imagine.